This is Where We Meet, sharing conversations from New Mexico and beyond. I'm Alice Morillon. Taos Center for the Arts would like to recognize that it operates on the homelands of the Red Willow people of Taos Pueblo. We'd like to honor the ongoing dedication and importance of Native and Indigenous cultures within our community and within the land we live, learn, and exist on. Our guest today is writer Miriam Sagan. Sagan has written books of poetry, novels, and essays. Her latest work, Commune of the Golden Sun, came out in January of 2024. In this fast-paced, upbeat conversation, Sagan tells us about the writing scene in Santa Fe in the 80s. She also shares the importance she sees in supporting other writers in getting their work out into the world, along with the complexities of that task. She touches on the role of inheritance in her creative work and what education can do for one, both in personal and professional realms. Miriam, thanks for being here with us today. I'm super excited to talk with you. You're a writer. You've published works of poetry, essays, memoirs, I think about 30 books altogether, maybe a little more. And you've been living in Santa Fe since 1984. Where you write and teach. You graduated from Harvard, and then you got an MA in creative writing from Boston University. In Santa Fe, you founded the creative writing program at Santa Fe Community College, and you taught there for years. Your work has been noticed and awarded, and you have participated in residencies across the world. Alongside this, you're also a co-founder of the collaborative press Tres Chicas Books. So I feel like there's a lot to discuss here. Thank you so much for joining us. And I wonder if you want to add anything to this brief introduction so people can really know who we're talking with today.
That is a complicated question. I'm happy to be here. A person is many different things, right? And I'm going to let you stick with the bio note and let's see what else comes out in the conversation.
That sounds good. Well, first off, I wanted to talk about your writing because I was struck with how multifaceted it is. You write poetry, essays, memoirs, novels, and it seems like no matter what shapes it takes, there is something that is driving you to write. And do you know what that is?
Wow. I think I only understand partially, the same way any human being only understands partially what is driving you to, to cook for the homeless shelter, what is driving you to fight with your mother. We don't always, I maybe never, have 100% understanding. So I think also things change over the course of a lifetime. I mean, when I was a very small child, I was basically obsessed with whatever language I could find, which would have been nursery rhymes, Mother Goose. I'm born in the mid-50s, and there's a lot of rock and roll that kind of explodes on the car radio. I mean, Motown, and I was mesmerized. I don't think I realized that other people, weren't thinking about the lyrics from the Supremes, all day long in math class, but I was. So you could say it's a general sensitivity. And then obviously, what is going to be expressed is going to change with each decade or each change in life. For me, I think there's a lot of energy between the personal experience and historical experience, that and artistic experience, not my own, but in the realm of the arts. And coming to New Mexico was just mind-boggling in terms of a kind of waking up or an ability to wake up to what was around me, starting with landscape.
Thank you. Well, that's actually a question I had for you. I was wondering why 40 years ago you chose Santa Fe as the place to leave. I think it's 40 years ago, if I did the math right.
Since 1984. Yeah, maybe a lot of years. I mean, it's about, yeah, I think you're right. Yes.
So what draw you here? Was it the physical landscape, the cultural landscape, a mix of those?
Well, like many people who came to Santa Fe in the 80s, I came by mistake. It was fortuitous, right? It was serendipitous. It was my good fortune. And I guess to be able to stay, that was my decision.
Right. And what led that decision to stay? What made you stay?
Well, there were amazing writers when I came to Santa Fe, who I had never heard of. There were amazing poets, people who are now actually long gone, but Leo Romero, Arthur Xie, Maymay Bressenburg, Joan Logie. There was this dynamic but quiet poetry scene, very different than the sort of showy, divisive Bay Area scene where you had to be, you had to pick an intellectual or conceptual way of presenting yourself. This was very spacious. And I actually edited a book, I'd only been here a few years, called New Mexico Poetry Renaissance, because there were so many poets here. And it was just, it was exquisite. I felt I had landed upon a treasure trove. I mean, in Taft's Rene Gregorio, really just an amazing group of people.
Can you describe a little bit for us what that was like, what that felt like to be around all those writers at the time?
Well, it felt very much like the beginning of something. There weren't a lot of institutions. And it felt, in Santa Fe, I mean, even Santa Fe felt like anything could happen. I was in a punk rock band against my will completely. I don't like punk rock, and I did not like the people in the band, okay? Let's just be honest. And we were called Poetry Devils, and we toured the state, and it was this kind of wild thing that could not really happen somewhere else, because I was naive. I mean, I was not that a person's a professional punk rocker, but I didn't know a lot about spoken word backed by wall of noise. And yet it was open to me. It had that spacious quality. There was a fundraiser at the El Dorado in the first few years I was here where an Erik Satie piece was played for 24 hours and something like 24 poets or maybe 48 poets read continuously all night and all day. So that was the kind of thing, you know what real estate was not that expensive. There weren't a lot of cliques where you must act this way. It wasn't academic. Luminous Animals was kind of jazz band out of Taos that had a lot of spoken word associated with it. It was sort of like you could try anything and you could fail and nothing bad happened. I mean, that's a great gift, right?
It is. Thank you. I want to go back to something you said about editing the New Mexico, I forgot the title.
New Mexico Poetry Renaissance. I did it with Sharon Niederman, and I was the other editor on it.
Thank you. And I wonder, the press, Tres Chicas Books, that's a collaborative press, and I wonder what that word really means in that context.
Well, what it meant for us, the press is not active at the moment, but okay. It published numerous authors. Essentially, it was a collective where the author came on to the collective temporarily. So it was not a permanent, it was the three editors, Joan Logie, Rene Gregorio, and myself, working equally, but not identically. And let's say we were going to publish a book of yours, you would come on and you would be able to have feedback about what's the cover. What's the type? You would buy yourself copies and then you'd sell them. The press never took any money. We didn't function as a sales agency. So the author had a fair amount of responsibility and all of the profit. So that's a collective experience. It was based on Alice James, which is a venerable collective in Boston. They had a more intensive process than we did. I think initially they used to teach their poets how to typeset, which is a skill that was worth something in those days. Now not so much.
Thank you. That sounds like a great collaborative system and really supportive of the writers, really putting them in the center of that process to get their word out. And I feel like up until recently, you also had a blog online. I think your last post was maybe in 2022. And it seems like, again, that was that process of sharing a platform for other writers and yourself, but really opening that door to others to get the word out. And I wonder if you can tell us about that relationship you build with the writers that you discover or that find you, and how you help them get that word out.
Well, you know, I think that deep in the heart of editors and writers, there's a somewhat adversarial connection. And I only know this from having been on both sides. which is when I was just a writer, I thought editors didn't love me as much as they should. And when I'm an editor, I think that writers are needy and whiny. Because I have other things to do than just love them. So knowing that what looks like that, what ideally should be a mutually supportive experience, can be fraught with expectation, I think that made me a sensitive editor, because I know how vulnerable a writer is. Right. You know, you say something like, I can't do, innovative spacing on a blog software. I can only go flush left. That sounds OK from the editor's viewpoint. From the writer, it's as if you stole their pussycat. You know, they do not like to hear the word flush left, because that it's meaningful to them. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Try to be sensitive to the differences in need, and just to be able to give people that space, you know, that square of a daily blog is tremendous. Although I have to say, as an editor, I also saw a lot of hesitation, self-doubt, fear. You know, I think I was perhaps a little naive. I thought, well, people are going to be happy to be able to just promote themselves for free. I'm the one who's got the 2,000 readers. They don't need to build audience. And yet you see the vulnerability of the creative process in that. And it kind of needs to be kind of nourished along a little bit, coaxed.
What do you mean by that fragility of the creative process? I'm not sure I got exactly what you mean by that.
Not everybody wants to expose themselves, or everyone feels they want to expose themselves. And then when they do, they feel scared, or they feel they see, of course, that it's the work is not perfect, because no work is ever perfect. Mm-hmm. So I've known people who, when they published their first book, they said, you know, I always wanted this book. It really was meaningful to me. And yet now that it's out, it's frightening. It's like, you know, it's like seeing your five-year-old dancing, you know, in a tutu, you know, at parent-teacher night, right? It's not just like happy and upbeat. There's, you've shown yourself, you've exposed yourself, mm-hmm. and it takes a long time to learn how to handle that, I think.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you. I want to shift the conversation a little bit from your editing work to the work you do with your daughter, I believe. I read that together you form an intergenerational creative team. And that team has an interesting name. It's called Maternal Mitochondria. So I wonder if you can tell us what is a maternal mitochondria and why you chose that name to describe your team.
Okay. Maternal mitochondria is part of the human genome. There are only 7 mothers of everyone on Earth. Some people call them the 7 Eves. But with all the dissension and war and hatred that we see, we all have 7, only 7 ancestors. And they all came from Africa. And some of them walked out of Africa over 30,000 year period, and some stayed, and some went into other parts of the world. So you can, National Geographic, you can do a little swab on your cheek, and we found out where our ancestresses came from. So it's, mitochondria is perhaps alien to human beings. It may be a somewhat different form of life that human beings captured to help them metabolize food. So it's very special, and you can see what it is, and it tells you your history just with a little swab in the mail. And so it's about inheritance, it's about ancestors, it's about where you came from. And so I happen to love these concepts, so I think the name came from me. My daughter also came from me. She did not seem to. I've never heard anything bad about the name from her. I've gotten feedback about my creative ideas that perhaps were less than complimentary, but not the name.
I love it. And if people didn't catch that in your explanation, I think that mitochondria, we only keep the part like symbol. In the sperm and egg cell, but when the embryo is formed, only the maternal one, the one from the mother, stays. And that's why you can trace back to the mothers, the 7 mothers you were talking about, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Together, you've been creating installations of art in unusual places. Why do you think it is important to bring art to places that are not made to, you know, receive art or not obviously made to do that?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And I think your background, you know, what you're doing is very linked into that. I love like what you find that you have overlooked, that you come upon. I mean, I've traced outsider art, folk art, land art for many, many years all over the country. And I like nothing better than to find something like a vending machine that has art in it in a lobby in a Santa Fe motel. I mean, that to me is heaven because it's unexpected, right? And it has no formality. It's, you don't walk into the museum. I mean, it just, you come upon it. And I mean, I think that's a very integrated way for art to be. So we did a series of installations in odd places. We did one during the pandemic on the abandoned campus of what was formerly College of Santa Fe. The buildings are still there. The city hasn't decided what to do with it. An organization called Vital Spaces had the offer of one of those buildings that was still heated, so you didn't have to worry about pipes breaking or whatever. And so we hired a friend of ours. You could send him a text. He would meet you there. He would open the building with the key, turn on the video. And when you were done, he would just close up after you. So this was, I mean, it was really like a service to the community because it meant you could go outside and see something with nobody else. Mm-hmm. And it was very special, very, very gratifying to be able to do that.
Thank you. And something you're saying about finding art in unexpected places, I feel like one can read that a lot in your work. I was reading 100 Cups of Coffee, and it's been with me since I knew we were going to talk. And I just kind of take little bits of it when I have time. And I feel like there's a lot of that notion of like the beauty of things is in a lot of usual places that have nothing special, but then when you look at it and spend that time, and suddenly you see the art. And I wonder if that's a way, if that's a way you look at your writing, your poetry, or if you would say it's a totally different process for you.
No, I think you've hit it. I have a lot of background in short forms, haiku, tanka that derive from the Japanese, really Japanese American or Americanized at this point. But I mean, really, my whole life I've followed kind of the momentary, the tiny little wake-up call, the metaphor, those things that are everywhere. And I'm glad you read 100 Cups. I'm very fond of it because it's really about the neighborhood. It's, well, it's about a lot of things, but it's also about having lived in this funky, unfashionable, you know, people say, oh, Santa Fe. Well, they have not been on the West Side. But the West Side is my it's my city. Do you know what I mean? It's my Paris, my Berlin, my Rome. It's just, it's funky as all get out, including my house. And it's every day there's something. Every day I see something or experience something that's the intersection of people and nature, civilization and decay, something funny, something sad. It's just, it's a very, very lively, for me, couple of blocks.
Thank you. I love that. You have quite impressive credentials, having graduated from Harvard and then getting a MA in creative writing from the University of Boston. And I was wondering what you would say, has this formal education contributed to your creative work?
Yeah. It's a great question because also it feels very long ago. I mean, I grew up in the New York area. I came from a family that very much valued education. And in a way, my life after that was much more of a kind of hippie, adventurous, right, artsy life. And yet there are big connections. I was very well trained. I was well trained in the technical aspects of poetry, the lyrical aspects. I had good mentors who were tough in their own way about human life, which at 18 or 19, I was not very tough. And I appreciated that. I appreciated Robert Fitzgerald, the classicist, was my teacher, and a man named Malcolm Brennan was also my teacher in graduate school. And they had a kind of, they weren't sentimental. They weren't sentimental about the artist's life. They weren't sentimental about their own suffering. And that was really good for me. So, and they love to teach. So I felt that, you know, Harvard took itself very seriously, and it felt very much that your life was going to improve by going there. Mm-hmm. And so does Santa Fe Community College. So I think I came prepared to feel that your education could potentially really help you a lot. And I think that value was transferable. I mean, even though the value of elitism was not something I wanted to transfer, but the idea that that this is serious and that you can benefit not just from a pay raise or a better job, but from feeling like you have access to things that maybe you felt you didn't. In my classes at community college, we'd often take a field trip to Museum Hill. Many people in the class had never been to the museum. They didn't know there were free days. People started bringing their kids on the field trip. People started bringing their girlfriends on the field trip. People would say, I can go to the museum now. It was like, that to me is so powerful. You should not be excluded as a citizen of your city from, you know, what you've essentially paid for with your taxes anyway. But there's an intimidation. How do I act? Is it okay? Where do I park? Mm-hmm. And so I think that I think I learned or believe still that self-assurance opens up creative worlds. It really does.
You created and directed the creative writing program at the Santa Fe Community College. And you touched on that just now, on what it could bring to the students. But I was wondering, when you created that program and now looking back on it, what do you think that program can do to its students? And maybe that's everything you just shared, but maybe there's a little more to that.
The program had like a very large variety of people in it. It had senior citizens, lots and lots of people going back to school who had always wanted to be creative or do something with writing and had had other professional lives. It had lots of high school students from the master's program. So I think the cross-fertilization between old and young, and then, of course, you know, standard students, it was, some of it was people driven by passion. Some of it was people who wanted that extra add-on as a way to be with themselves and with other people. And then the creative power of youth, which is just eating up whatever it can get.
Well, thank you so much for that. Now I want to go back to the work you're doing writing. I think your latest book was published in January of this year, 2024, and it's called Commune of Golden Sun. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how it came to be?
Yes, of course, you know, everyone likes to talk about their most recent offspring. it's my baby of the moment. It's a short novel. It's a novella. It was written during the pandemic. It's about a commune in central New Mexico that closes its doors. Essentially, the setup is that the then president of the United States, referred to as the tyrant, refuses to concede the election, and there's civil war. And so this is the backstory. The commune, about 100 people, 120 people. And of course, New Mexico was famous during the 60s for its communes. But this is a long-lived counterculture institution. I mean, it's not real, but it's real to me. So they seal it off and they tell the children who come along generation by generation that the world has been destroyed. There's no world. And by the time my four central protagonists are 12 and 13, they have suspicions. And by the time they're 16 and 17, they decide to leave, which is going to break the hearts of their parents and parental figures. But they want to know. And of course, the world has not been destroyed. It's a post-apocalyptic world, a post-Civil War world, which is unfortunately a lot like ours. There's been this huge idealistic resistance to tyranny, and now there's sort of usual problems that we see. Mm-hmm. So it's their adventure and what happens to them and how they're unified. It's also about a young girl's search for her mother, who she thinks has abandoned her, but is actually trying to find her.
I did not give you a heads up on that question, so it's okay if it cannot work. But I was wondering if you would be willing to read for us maybe a little bit of that book, a section, if there is a section that comes to mind.
I'd be delighted. It's always a little bit hard to figure out what part of a novel to read, but I think I'm going to start with the beginning because there's things that I didn't know when I started and that the reader can't know yet. So it kind of gives that atmosphere. I'll read maybe 2-3 pages, something
Sounds
like that.
Good.
You know, less than 5 minutes. So this is Myra, and she's becomes the antagonist. It starts with her point of view, and it starts in about, I guess a couple years from now, just a few years in the future. And this is about mothers and daughters. She's speaking of her daughter. She was still so little back then. She'd point and say moon. If she said salt, she'd add pepper. Everything was in pairs. She liked that, including the two of us. She could say rain because I used to take her to one of the ruined fake places, the indoor arcade where it still rained from the painted ceiling 4 times an hour. There were no longer lights, so the sky didn't darken before the storm, but it still rained faithfully on the quarter hour. And this is set in Las Vegas, Nevada. Of course, Vegas was always dry. It was the desert. After all, I'd lived there my whole life, and I was used to it. But now the Colorado River was dry, the reservoir so low that every little town or ranch or ancient ruin it had drowned was now exposed again to sunlight. My mother used to say, someday we'll turn on a water faucet and sand will pour out. She was dead before that seemed like a real possibility, before I realized that she hadn't been exaggerating. We were going to have to go. I knew that. I was just putting it off. There was still plenty to eat. I'd stored up, and the Looters Union had hundreds of stalls at the market. It would be years before we starved, but that wasn't a plan. I kept thinking I could manage, and we loved each other, me and my tiny girl. We were all the other person had in this world, and that was fine with me. She was 2 years old, and I was 32, without a man. And then Jake, who's the father of the child, says he's going to go to the commune of the Golden Sun, and Myra says, well, he says, I'm going and you'd better come for the child's sake. And Myra flips out and says, touch either of us and I'll slit your throat when you sleep. I surprised even myself. Myra, he said softly, we used to be friends. We used to be lovers. I care about you. I love the girl. She's mine too. I'll kill you, I said. So we left. But then she has to go after him. So that's the initial setup.
Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing this. I can't wait to read the rest. I'm going to have to get that book. Well, Miriam, thank you so much for your time this morning. Before we wrap up the conversation, I wonder if there's anything else, any thoughts, anything you'd like to add for our listeners today, or if living on that note on what you just read is a good way of living.
Well, I will share something, which is, I think when I was young, I felt that writing was really going to help me. And then in middle age, I became more cynical. And now that I'm almost 70, I'm back to my original thought that writing is going to help us. So if you ask yourself the question, is my creative process going to help me? I would say not every minute of every day, but in the long run, yes, stick with it. That's my note.
Thank you so much. I love hearing that.
Thanks for everything. It was great to talk to you.
You just heard the opening scene of Commune of the Golden Sun, the latest novel by Miriam Sagan. Thank you to Sagan for sharing her work and thoughts with me today. Where We Meet comes from Taos Center for the Arts in Taos, New Mexico. Producers include Chelsea Reedy, Anna Forster-Smith, and myself, Alice Morillo. On Where We Meet, we share conversations from New Mexico and beyond. Thanks for listening. Be well.